I'll be moderating the question so we can be fair about this. I see one over here.
First, thank you very much. The first is, what chance do you think those appellate decisions have of being upheld by the Supreme Court?
Yeah, that's a... Well, I think the easier decisions are going to be the decisions that go to matters of secrecy in government. I just think it's so offensive to the courts that, and to all of us, that we would run a democratic society with so much information kept from the public. So I have hope for those cases. It's going to be hard because national security concerns are there, and there was a Third Circuit argument, I guess, 2 days ago or yesterday, 2 days ago in one of the cases that challenges the rule that immigration judges are going to be closed to the public, and one of the judges was quite concerned and made the comment that he was not going to do anything that would result in thousands of deaths, I think is how he put it. At any rate, it's going to be difficult, but I think we have to get some clarity on some of these issues in the courts, and we really are in a state of constitutional law where a lot of these issues are very open.
You mentioned a number of specific things that you object to, and I'm in full agreement with you, and I think probably everybody can hear you. You also challenged us through the name of Margaret Mead to change the world. What is your vision of the world, of the changed world, and how do you hope to get there?
Well, right. Do I have the help of everyone in the room? Because then it can happen. But what we've done in the last year is we've backtracked. And I'm actually talking about catching up to where we were. And then we can go forward. But in the past year, so much has been lost. We've seen racial profiling of Arabs and Muslims. We've seen their arbitrary detention. We've seen the closing of public discourse. We've backtracked from the principles that bind us, and we have to get back to where we were before we can even talk about moving forward.
Has it been anything specifically related to women that now organizations should be concerned?
Well, in fact, the individuals who've been detained have almost exclusively been men, but I think all of us are impacted when we have a administration that is not letting us know who it's surveilling or how it's using its powers of surveillance. I think that a lot of innocent people can get caught up, men and women, in some of the USA Patriot Act provisions that allow for enhanced surveillance. I think that all of us have to question whether we censored ourselves when we heard John Ashcroft tell us that those who cry about civil liberties are giving aid and comfort to the enemy. And I think that statement caused a lot of people to keep some of their views to themselves. I think that's antithetical to a democratic society, and I think that that affects all of us. And in terms of now, I think now has done such an extraordinary work. On behalf of women, and we have another minority group that's under attack. It's being discriminated against in many, many ways by the government in terms of detentions, and then, of course, there's a spillover effect in the private sector, in employment and elsewhere. And so I think there's a lot of wisdom that now has that could be shared.
Right, can I see all hands so that I can, can't actually read what that says. I'm going to go... Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
My question is, I've read your excerpt from this book on the website, and it's excellent, and I encourage everyone to buy it. But you have clearly read the entire 342 pages of the Patriot Act. What was it like to read that?
Oh, no. Oh, yes. No, I won't claim to have read the whole thing. I read the provisions that were of concern from a civil liberties viewpoint. And it's absolutely this recycled product. For the last 10 years, the administration has been trying to increase its surveillance powers with the advent of the Internet. This is all recycled stuff. Some of it's a little bit, well, I think some of the immigration provisions, which I didn't even mention to you, are absolutely extraordinary and breathtaking, and perhaps they weren't in the works before. I mean, there's a provision that allows for the mandatory detention of immigrants charged with acts of terrorism until the point of the decision in their case, which could be months and months and months. And the problem is that the definition of terrorism is so broad that it technically would include a barroom brawl in which someone picked up a makeshift weapon. It really just requires a weapon and an act, a crime, not for monetary gain. That might be new, but this was definitely a wish list that the crisis was the excuse to get it into place.
Have you asked a question about the more violent aspects of how the government's doing stuff, like a Palestinian friend of mine was arrested out of Queens at this Irish-American guy's house when he was living there? He got busted April 26th. He's still in jail. Of course, he's in INS jail for immigration, right? They claim like he was like off September 11th and he had explosives in the house and kind of entered in there. And going to enter anyway through the lawyers, so just let him in, they're going to come in anyway. And so the guy Bernie, the American-Irish guy, he's like, they're yelling at him, the cops, the INS, are like the FBI and stuff, and they're like, oh, we're going to get you, you're harboring a terrorist, you're a traitor, we're going to get you. 2 weeks later, Bernie's put on board, he gets qualified in the back of the head, gets 27 stitches, and he was knocked unconscious, and the guy right before he walked him says, told you. Traitor, bank one, didn't even take any money, so that was suspect. And then another friend of mine who belongs to the Palestinian organization I belong to, Al Alvin of Boston, he's driving, he has a traffic violation, he's Palestinian too. He has a traffic violation, they see some flies in his car for an anti-Israel protest in Boston. He gets to the police station, the FBI takes him, tear gas beats him, then he goes to INS. Then a couple of weeks later, after that, the Yankees now pull this woman. And claim that, oh, we had emergency dental work to be done, you know, and it's like after feet of interrogated, and it was like all four molars have been removed at once, and they wanted to make him sign a paper. In English, it wasn't his best friend, you know what I'm saying? He's like, well, I'm not going to sign something I don't understand. The lawyer and his friend saying, don't sign it. They got disconnected, he didn't sign it, but in the end, he got deported to Canada, but his teeth are all messed up, and they've been tortured. So what do we do when you call, when your lawyers are trying to help out you in this situation, you can't get any help, you get all the good legal people trying to help you, who do you call and, you know, this is some banger.
Yeah, no, just very quickly, I mean, woman was describing a series of incidents in which violence has been directed by, I guess, law enforcement agents against Arab and Muslim immigrants who have committed minor violations, immigration violations. It's a horrific problem, and I just mentioned one case that the Center for Constitutional Rights is working on called Turkman v. Ashcroft, and it's brought as a class action, but the named plaintiffs are seven men who were picked up after 911, who many of whom were beaten, thrown around by guards, and taunted, told that they were terrorists based solely on their religion and ethnicity. All were eventually released, but only after months and months and months. Even after the point where they agreed to leave this country, they were kept for months and months and months because the FBI apparently was conducting some sort of terrorism investigation. But these are individuals who just have absolutely no connection there. There are many other stories of individuals. And so just to get back to that case, we're seeking money damages on behalf of those individuals, which we hope will send some sort of message to the INS and the Bureau of Prisons. But it's a very difficult problem. And, this is when we see our government sanctioning racial profiling, then it becomes okay to do it on a private level. And, you know, it becomes okay for prison guards to act in this way. And that's one of the most disturbing fallouts from the racial profiling that we've been seeing. And I guess everyone knows the story about the medical students at Shoney's in Georgia who were, a woman claimed that she heard them talking about a plan to commit a terrorist act. And they denied it. They were released from jail, but they apparently have lost their positions in the hospital that they had been assigned to.
Well,
Oh, I'm glad to hear it. I'm glad to hear that. Good.
I came out a little late, so I apologize if my question covers ground that we've already talked about. Well, two things. One of the things that strikes me is that the Patriot Act is very badly named because it suggests that anybody who isn't for it is not PBI. The other thing is the time it has taken people to reverse liberties that have been gained over the last, you know, almost 400 years. And it's been very short. And there are two levels at which one might need to attack this. One is obviously the individuals who are already in jail, their liberties need to be looked after. But there's also, I'm wondering how one can go about reversing what's already been done in a legislative manner.
Yeah. Yeah, well, first of all, that the name of the act not being, well, I think it was very clever. It's very hard to vote against a law called the USA Patriot Act. I think they spent more time working out the name of this act than actually on its provisions. But in terms of the how quickly we've seen a decline in our civil liberties and what we can do about it, yeah. Well, I think that we have to get our Congress people to take this seriously. The dynamic is this. It's very easy to grandstand and come out tough on terrorism. It's not so easy for example, a liberal Democrat to make it a cause to get rid of the USA Patriot Act. I mean, there's no popular support at this point. And that's where we have to, that's one issue that we have to work on. There has to be popular support. But I think that, as I mentioned earlier, we have to think about those provisions that are going to sunset. That means that Congress has to take an affirmative act to get them back into law. We need to rally around letting these sunset, letting them expire. And at the same time, we have to focus on some of the provisions that are in there that are permanent that we should be getting rid of.
I think it was Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis who wrote a historical essay about the restrictions on civil liberties that have happened repeatedly in U.S. history during wartime. And the essay was a warning about this. But at the same time, a part of that essay was the idea that there are these restrictions that happen during wartime, but so far, every time, those restrictions have been loosened again after the war was over. And at some point in your talk, you said something about how these restrictions could happen and then never be loosened again.
Right.
And I think one of the conditions Louis Brandeis mentioned was having an executive in power who managed to somehow stay in power, who changed the rules so that he never had to leave power. But I'm wondering, short of that and short of the idea, the obvious notion that this is an unending war against terrorism, there's no end in sight, unlike other wars that end after 4 years, 10 years. I'm wondering if, like, from the point of view of a legal scholar, are there reasons why the restrictions that are coming into act right now might be very hard to lift or impossible to loosen later?
Well, one of the issues I'm concerned about is that the cat is out of the bag in terms of privacy. There's the loss of privacy. I think with technological developments, and I had mentioned these data mining companies, so much is known about so many people, and the government has access to that information that I think we could try to repeal some of these provisions, but I think that some damage has been done permanently in that regard. Well, as long as there's a threat of terrorism, I just don't see Congress lifting, for example, some of the provisions that allow looser standards for foreign intelligence surveillance. I hope it happens, and I think we have to work for it. But as long as there's the ability of the government to point to a real or imagined threat of a future terrorist attack, I just don't think we're going to be seeing changes in the current structure of surveillance law, for example.
But from what you're saying, that the increase of surveillance, there's a change in technology that has increased the capacity for surveillance, and then there's legal structures that support that, which are mostly corporate, like the right of cookies. I don't honestly know much about how this works legally, and that this is sort of in some way preceded this war on terror, and I don't know much about the law.
Right. Well, yeah. Well, yeah, there's been a question for years as to how we're going to go about protecting privacy in the age of the Internet. And we've, in the Patriot Act, for example, in one provision, we've probably very much loosened. We've applied a very loose model, very easy standard for the government to meet in Internet tracking. And that there's an open question as to whether the government can, without any suspicion of a crime, obtain information about our web surfing. That's just one of many examples. I think there's just so many open-ended questions with the new technology and how we're going to be dealing with those issues.
Gentlemen with the glasses.
We've been, media have been saying that reporting that Ashcroft has removed the old restrictions on CalPro or such as they were, or reauthorized it. Can you say more exactly of what he's done and what signs there are of the FBI getting more money for it or organizing toward it? Obviously, it's covert actions, CIA-style covert actions. We don't know what they're doing until long after it happened, but there could be some signs in terms of both of what Ashcroft started, but also what the FBI is doing.
Well, this is a question about FBI surveillance guidelines and covert action, right? And, well, this, back in the 1970s, this is actually an interesting story, but the COINTEL program was only discovered by a break-in by a committee, a citizens committee, to protect us from the FBI. And once it was exposed, the Senate Church Committee, under the leadership of Senator Frank Church, convened a series of meetings and conducted a very thorough investigation and came up with a very thorough report documenting the abuses under the COINTEL program. And after that, the Attorney General, Edward Levy at the time, issued a set of guidelines that placed some constraints on surveillance and cut out the dirty tricks. And over the years, various attorney generals have shifted that and made it easier for the FBI to do more surveillance. And in May of this year, Attorney General Ashcroft issued new guidelines for domestic surveillance that were already quite loose and allowed investigations, preliminary investigations, to take place on very, very low standards, a reasonable indication of some sort of criminal activity. And he's overtly said that at this point, FBI agents are free to go to mosques, public spaces like that, and to go on the web and do web searches and to use the sort of data mining company data that I was mentioning earlier. So I think we're going to see more aggressive FBI intelligence in the future. We may not see it, actually, because it's going to be covert, but it'll only be if people are indicted of a crime that we might understand what methods are being used to obtain this information. But it's a very serious problem, and it's gotten much worse under Ashcroft's watch.
Nancy, I just really want to thank you for doing this book because it takes a lot of courage to do this. And I know it took a lot of courage to stare right in the eye of that act and look at what it represents. I'm really feeling that what people have talked about fear is very vulnerable. Just a short example, I was at a rally in front of the Justice Department last Friday that Jesse Jackson called against John Ashcroft. And it was a very inspiring rally, but a black woman who happened to work for the government stopped. And she said, you know what, this is all well and good, but aren't you scared about what you're doing? I'm in the government, I see what you're doing. Aren't you scared? And how can you be out here showing your face in front of the Justice Department? And I think that's an issue that we really have to tackle. How can we get the word out about how bad the situation is without further scaring people into inaction?
just one example. I hope people saw the ad in the Times today, not in our name. Let it not be said that people in the United States did nothing when their government declared a war without limit and instituted starkly measures of repression. I really feel like we need to find the ways to speak out, and especially to speak to middle America right now, and give people the courage and heart to stand up against this. You've got to spread your book around and all these kinds of materials and help people understand that they can only get away with this with the acquiescence of those of us that don't want to.
That's very well put. Thank you. Yeah.
Before I ask my question, I just want to point out that I don't know how many people here are familiar with FreeTheDotNet, but actually in 1998, Paul Guerin and some other people, they sued the Network Solutions and brought suits to the government on the issues of privacy with the internet to open up domain names and who can allocate them. Because even before this happened, every word you've ever written or read is on file somewhere and totally open, and there were things like Gargantua and other FBI programs that, you know, go through all the servers continuously looking for buzzwords, and they're already kind of, they were doing that even before the Patriot Act. And if you're concerned about internet privacy, FreeTheDotNet is a great organization to support because they've been on the front lines for, you know, the past 5 years, really, really working hard on that. But I'm wondering if somewhere there's a list of all of the different provisions that have happened. There's, you know, I notice every time there's a, you know, something comes up where, you know, skepticism over 911 happens, another law comes out, and, you know, I know there's been more money spent investigating Monica Lewinsky's Come Stain Dress than this event that changed our entire country. And I've seen things on the news like, you know, okay, well, now we're just going to have to let, the next attack's going to be on private property, so we need to come into your apartment building. Be aware, that's changed. Operation TIPS, where they're trying to get, you know, a million citizens to spy on other citizens. Is there somewhere where all of that stuff is cataloged and listed so that, you know, you can point to it and look at the whole body of action
happening? That's what I try to do in my book. I used a lot of different sources in writing it. There are groups that specialize in electronic information and privacy issues. There are groups that specialize in immigration issues. But I really haven't seen a resource that puts everything together. And that was the effort or the reason why I wanted to write something. I felt that a lot of separate pieces were taking place, chipping away at our civil liberties, and no one was really stepping back and looking at the big picture, the First Amendment issues, the privacy issues, the profiling issues.
I see lawyers as folks in the front lines as far as struggling against this repression, and I wonder what impact you think the Lynn Stewart case is going to have on lawyers continuing to do this without being threatened. They're likely to be
Right. Does everyone know about Lynn Stewart, a civil rights attorney here in New York who's taken on a number of controversial clients, including Sheikh Abdelrahman, who was convicted for planning some bombings in the New York City area? And she was apparently monitored under a warrant under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Her conversations were recorded, and an indictment, including a charge of material support, was brought against her. I think that between her arrest, but also this attorney-client monitoring regulation that I mentioned that came out last October, I think that there's not too many candid and frank discussions taking place in jails between attorneys and their clients, which I can only think is impeding the defense of people who are now in prison. And it's a serious problem. I've even heard of a further step against attorneys, which is a discussion about regulations that would require attorneys to turn in their clients to the government if they had evidence of financial transactions involving terrorists. So this is very serious. The bar is also under attack here.
I have a couple of questions. First, I'm wondering if there are judicial challenges to the Patriot Act in progress, in particular to the overly general definition of terrorism.
There are no challenges yet that I can think of right now to the Patriot Act provisions, at least the ones I've talked about. But I should mention that the immigration provisions, as expansive as the powers are of the government and the INS over immigrants under the Patriot Act, the government was not satisfied, and the government went ahead and issued interim rules and regulations that gave to itself, the executive branch, unilaterally, even more powers. So the detentions we've seen actually have been pursuant to not the statute, but to regulations. And there have been some challenges, certainly the one I mentioned to you, the Turkmen case, raising questions about the detention of individuals well past any reasonable length of time to determine their immigration status and to get them out of the country if they're deportable. And then I mentioned to you the FOIA case, the Freedom of Information Act case, where at least the identities of individuals is sought. The government's tried to withhold that. And I mentioned that Judge Gladys Kessler has issued an order releasing those names, but what I don't think I mentioned is that she stayed her own order pending appeal, which is fairly typical in a Freedom of Information Act request, because once the information is out, the cat is out of the bag. Healed that. And there's also been those cases I mentioned involving the closed hearings at the immigration judge level, which seemed to be going well, except for that argument in the Third Circuit 2 days ago, where we have some signs that at least one of the judges is concerned about releasing any information having anything to do with any 911 detention.
No, actually, you've already had a pit. How about you?
I was wondering about the kind of challenges you could make that one could make that would take the message to the larger public. It seems unlikely that businesses would really react. For example, all the financial services firms, I don't see them really being indignant about having to give information to the government. But what about a bookstore? Is anyone considering
right.
having well, advice? The other thing that seems obvious to me is with the Fair Credit Reporting Act, we all have access, threats of access and corrections to our credit reports. What about these other mass databases that consumer reporting agencies maintain about political affiliations or president's mass grouping? Couldn't you get most of America riled up about wanting access to that information?
The last question was about getting Americans riled up about their privacy in terms of databases, political affiliations, and the like. And I think we have to try to do that. I think that's one of the a really good rallying point. At the same time, we repeal some of the Patriot Act provisions. We should be calling for greater protection of databases. The first question is, who's upset about government surveillance, particularly of third-party records that are being held on us, for example, by the companies we deal with? And libraries and bookstores have been very upset about this and have there's some great websites explaining the Section 215 of the Patriot Act that allows a lot of these records to be obtained by the government. One thing I should mention, though, is that when the government issues a warrant to a bookstore or a library or other, or a car rental company or a hotel, that order is going to have a gag order component, a provision that actually says that the person receiving the order will be in contempt of court if they disclose the very existence of the order to anyone else. So that's why we haven't heard so much about what's going on. One of the reasons. Most third parties that hold our records are not very concerned about us. They're trying to do their patriotic thing. And so we've heard a lot of reports of compliance with government requests for information without resistance. I hope that stops, but the dynamics are not good for us, our side of it.
There's no recourse then if you're served a warrant.
Oh, they can the third party can challenge it. It's just that there's just very little motivation for them to challenge it. If you're a hotel, what do you care? I mean, you don't want to be seen as impeding a discovery of a terrorist and having on your head the next explosion. You don't want to spend the resources on an attorney to go out and fight the gag order. There's just not a lot of motivation there.
I was listening to a TV program on Like It Is, in which there was an attorney. I don't know if you saw that one, but he was from the South, and he was discussing the fact that not a single person who read the entire act had the actual meaning of it, because it made sense to so many different other acts that, you know,
yes,
it was impossible,
right,
to get a picture.
Right.
Exactly what that would mean.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been possible. And a lot of Congress people acknowledged that they did not read the act before signing it. And worse than that, the House Judiciary Committee had a more civil liberties-friendly version of it. And the House leadership under Dennis Hastert, under pressure from the administration, replaced that with the current law. And it was very anti-democratic, but the full House Judiciary Committee voted in favor of their bill. It was just a lot of pressure was put on at a time when, if you'll recall, Congress wasn't even in its own offices. It had some anthrax-laced letters had been sent to to Tom Daschle and others, and John Ashcroft was getting on the television right around that time in mid-October explaining that there was going to be another terrorist attack, or there was likely, rather, to be another terrorist attack. So our Congress just rolled over under the pressure. They did not want the blame for any future incidents.
Actually, that wasn't my question. I was just saying that as a preface. But my question really is how do you go about talking about this in the future and changing things? And I think one of the things I noticed is that we haven't seen enough debate in the political arena. I mean, and take a country like Israel, for example. They've been a victim of terrorist acts before, many, many of them. You do see some debate going on in their political arena. You have the extremists, and you have various other positions. Whereas here you have two parties, but they're pretty much going along the same line of action. There's not enough debate, and I think that one could, for example, take this issue to town hall meetings. And I also have never seen anything that says that this particular measure is going to be effective stopping what it's supposed to stop. And I think that's really the issue to be raised. I mean, I think the politicians want to do something anyway to look like they're doing something. But who knows what it's going to actually result in.
Right. I think everyone's scared. I think people in Congress are scared. And we're not going to see them show any backbone. And if in a climate like this. But that's why I think, it's essential that we speak out and make our views known, because these things have an inertia. I mean, the more people who do speak out, the more I just think the more our chances of actually getting someplace on this is. So I'm not without hope. I wouldn't have written the book if I didn't have any hope. I think that we're on the right side, and we just have to make our case.
So Ms. Chang is going to be signing books in the back here in the little room to the left. And that's going to close the question and answer period. Thank you so much for coming, and thank you to Nancy Chang.
Thank you, everybody. Really appreciate it.
Thank you again for coming, and please join Now New York City. The membership forms are right in your packet and on the back of the trifold brochure.